I'll give a short talk and then we'll do some reflection exercises, I think, because I'd rather it was a kind of workshop type evening to give you some ideas about reflection. Not that I'm going to teach you how to reflect, because I think everyone knows how to reflect already, especially Buddhists. I think anybody who's human reflects in a way. It's what makes us human, is our ability to reflect. Somebody, just as I was coming in, asked me if I could weave in the question of what's the difference between, or are they the same, between mindfulness and reflection. So I'm going to weave that in straight away. Reflection is an aspect of mindfulness. What is mindfulness? Mindfulness is reflection. Mindfulness is reflexive self-awareness. When you're mindful, you're not only aware of what you're doing, but you're also aware of being aware of what you're doing. It's that circular thing, isn't it, that can drive you mad if you're not careful. So we're aware of being aware. So I might do something and I'm aware that I've done it. And then reflection comes in when I reflect about that action that I've just done. You could say that reflection is mindfulness with thought. Mindfulness with thought. Because you can be aware of what you're doing completely thoughtlessly. I don't mean that in the pejorative sense of thoughtlessly, but without really thinking about what you're doing. And I'm sure you've experienced that. This is what happens when you're in a state of flow, isn't it? Do you know the state of flow? The great Hungarian psychologist, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, spent most of his life studying the state of flow, which is the state that people get into when they're doing something that they really enjoy and they're good at it, but it really, the thing that they're doing takes skill, and their skill is just about equal to the task they're doing. If the task you're doing is too easy, you get bored and your mind wanders. If it's too difficult, you become stressed. So the state of flow is that in-between state when what you're doing is, it really requires you to be fully present and fully mindful. Then you enter into the state of flow, and it can be a very thoughtless state. Sometimes when I'm teaching, I get people to get into the state of flow quite easily. It's quite easy to get people in. Do you know the following hands exercise, where you go in twos? You and I could show. That's, okay, so I'm going to put my hand out, and you just put your hand on top of mine, that's right, and I'm just going to move around. You have to close your eyes and follow my hand. Okay, do you ever do this in classes? Okay, thank you. And so I get people to do that, and variations of, and I just look at them and I can tell by their faces that some of them are in this wonderful, blessed state of thoughtless concentration. You can just see the beatific smiles on their faces. So that's the state of flow. But reflection is when you're thinking about your experience or about the Dharma. So let's put reflection within the Buddhist context. Actually, before I go down that road, it might be that you already know this, so I need to check. How many of you have read the introduction to my book? Put your hands up. Not that many of you. So, okay. So in that case, with apologies to those of you who already read the introduction to my book, I'm going to situate reflection within the Buddhist tradition. And you'll know this already, those of you who have read the introduction. So you've got the three levels of wisdom. How many of you have heard of the three levels of wisdom, or the three wisdoms? A different bunch of people who brought their hands up for reading the introduction of my book. Okay, so those of you who, you'll know that there's, first of all, there's Sutta Maya Panya. So wisdom here is Panya, Pali, I'm going to use the Pali. Panya means wisdom or knowledge. It has that dual meaning. You know there's a difference, don't you, between wisdom and knowledge. Do you know that? We know that kind of intuitively, don't we? That we can meet someone who knows a lot, but we don't really regard them as very wise. Yeah. And you might sometimes meet someone who doesn't know very much, but they seem to be very, very wise. So we kind of intuitively know the difference between them. So panya in Pali can mean both or either, and depending on the context, it means either wisdom or it means knowledge. Sutta maya panya. Maya means something like by means of or through, and sutta, S-U-T-A, this is not S-U-T-T-A, which means discourse, S-U-T-A, means to listen or to hear. But in the Pali English Dictionary, how many of you ever read the Pali English Dictionary? Let's have another show of hands. Okay. Sad but true, yeah. The Pali English Dictionary is actually wonderful. If you're an order member who gives talks, it's really, really useful to have the Pali English Dictionary. It can give you a talk for you, basically. You just look up a word, and it's fantastic what it tells you. And then you go and tell other people, and they think, where did he get that from? The P-E-D, Pali English Dictionary. So in there it says, for sutta, S-U-T-A, it says heard in special sense. Then in inverted commas, revelation. So sutta maya panya, you're not just listening to any old thing, any old body talking about any old thing. You're actually listening to someone who knows something that you don't. You're listening to the truth, some aspect of the truth, which has been revealed to you as someone who doesn't know it. That's what it really means. And it's very interesting that sutta, the word savaka comes from the word sutta, funny enough. It wouldn't seem so, would it? Sutta, savaka, but they are connected. And savaka means listener or hearer. And the Buddha's immediate disciples, though at least those disciples of his who had left home and become like he was, a wanderer, they were called savakas. And very often the word savaka is translated from Pali into English as disciple. Sometimes as hearer, but often as disciple. So you get that connection between listening and discipleship, which is quite an interesting connection. So sutta maya panya is to hear wisdom. And it's partly knowledge, but it also can be wisdom. Mustn't underestimate that first level of wisdom, sutta maya panya. I think sometimes in our modern Western society, this level of wisdom, or this type of knowing, is somewhat undervalued, because in our society there's a great premium, a great value placed on thinking for oneself, isn't there? One has to think for oneself. But in the ancient East, with Buddhism and so on, it wasn't seen as that great a thing to do, think for oneself. It didn't really matter where you got wisdom from, whether you thought it through yourself or somebody told you. Who cares where it came from, as long as it comes from somewhere. In fact, I would say sutta maya panya is seen as a very, very great form of wisdom. And of course, it's the way we usually gain wisdom in the early stages of our spiritual life. By early stages, I mean the first few lifetimes of our spiritual lives, where we're just learners. We're just learning how to practice. You know how hard it is, don't you, to practice the Dharma and really understand it? You can imagine it taking lifetime. Well, I can. At this rate of progress, we'll have to have lifetimes, won't we? So, sutta maya panya. I think that's all I need to say about that. I'm going to try and keep this short, you see, because we need to move on to doing things. Then you get chinta maya panya. That's the second level. So maya panya, same, wisdom through. But this time chinta, C-I-N-T-A, Pali English Dictionary, you look it up, it's just got one word, thought. Thought. Which is very, very interesting. This is the second level of wisdom, and there are only three levels. And it's seen as very, very important in Buddhism. And it's very, very interesting that at the moment, in the West, in Western Buddhist circles, thinking is not seen as a very good quality in many Buddhist circles, I would say. In fact, I would say in some Buddhist circles, it's discouraged. And I think the reason for that is because we place, or some Buddhist groups anyway, place so much emphasis on meditation, as if meditation were the Buddhist practice. It's quite interesting, that, isn't it? It does seem that many people see meditation as the Buddhist practice. there's the Buddha sitting in meditation. Is he sitting in meditation, though? What is he doing, I wonder? Is he meditating? He's got his eyes open. Maybe he's thinking about something. So maybe all these pictures and statues we see of the Buddha and others sitting there, we assume they're meditating, but that is an assumption, is it? Because we don't know what on earth they're doing. They might be thinking. And I would say the Buddha was a really great thinker. I think he spent quite a lot of his time thinking things through, as well as meditating, no doubt. I remember reading something by Camille Paglia, the rather controversial writer and thinker. And she said, I thought this is a great shame actually, she was at university somewhere in America, and she said she explored Buddhism a little bit, but she soon found out that they really didn't think thinking was a great thing to do, and she was a thinker, so she withdrew. What a pity. How many thinkers have we missed as in Buddhism because we don't seem to value it very highly? In fact, we seem to downgrade it. Not a good thing to do. Of course, it's not a great thing to do when you're meditating because you're supposed to be meditating, not thinking. But there is also the practice of thinking, and this becomes obvious with this three levels of wisdom. Thinking, thought. I've done a number of reflection workshops in the last year or two, and we always begin, don't know if you remember this, Kalyanavacha, we always begin by asking people what is their experience of reflection, what do you reflect, and so on. And very often, someone will say, well, I think, but I don't reflect. Do you remember someone saying that, Kalyanavacha? Yeah, I know. I know it was you, yeah, I didn't want to out you like that, though, okay. So, as if thinking and reflecting are two different things. And in a sense, they are. It depends on how you define them, doesn't it? You could say that reflection is a certain kind of thinking. It's a certain kind of thinking. And, thinking is very, very important, I think, as part of the spiritual life. As part of the spiritual life, I'll say again. A definite aspect of Buddhist practice. Not to be undervalued. We need to think about things. And I would say it's a definite human need, because we are reflective, because we've got reflexive self-awareness, therefore mindfulness. Things happen. We have to think about them. How many times have you done something and then felt uneasy about it afterwards? How many times does that happen in a week or a month? You speak to someone in a certain way and afterwards you feel a little uneasy about what the way you've spoken. And then, of course, we try to forget it, don't we? Oh, it's okay. Don't worry about it. At least some of us try to forget it. Put it behind you. Put it behind you. But it's actually quite difficult to do that. It takes quite a big effort of will to put behind you those little actions that you do that you later feel uneasy about. And I think probably eventually you probably have to think about them. Might happen at 3 o'clock in the morning. You wake up and it comes into your mind, doesn't it? Maybe it woke you up. You have to think about it. So I think that human beings do think. And there's a great emphasis on them at the moment, in some Buddhist circles anyway, and including our own movement, I would say, on the body, isn't there? We have to become embodied. We have to meditate in the body. Which is good, I think. It's a good emphasis, because we do tend to live up here, don't we, in our heads. The body become an appendage of our brain. But I think some people go too far in their teaching and their practice, and they try not to think at all. They try to have everything going on in the body. Just body awareness is, if that's absolutely everything. It's very important, body awareness, I would say, especially for us Westerners. But it's not everything. We do have a brain as well as a body. And just as we have to take the body with us to enlightenment, we have to take the brain with us to enlightenment. We can't leave that behind either. So we need to think about things. And there's millions of things to reflect on. Every day, loads and loads of things coming in. There's the Dharma to reflect on. Things that we've learned, things that we've read. Sangrakshita once said that for every 1 hour of learning you do, you have to do about 100 hours of reflecting. That's the ratio, 1 to 100. Which is a massive ratio, isn't it? Massive. So reflecting on the Dharma, that is also reflecting on ourselves, what's going on with us, things that have happened to us, things that we've done, things that we've said. Reflecting on things that happened there in the world. Just have to pick up a newspaper and there's hours and hours worth of reflecting material, isn't there? Or watch the news. So much reflection to do. Even watching things on the telly, not the news, not connected with current affairs, can give you masses of things to reflect on. So there's a lot to reflect on. And I would say that we haven't really come to grips with this in our movement. I mean, Sangharaksha is a great thinker, I think. He's a real great inspiration for me, for thinking. I wrote this book, The Art of Reflection, and it's only when I was writing it that I realised that there aren't any books on reflection. There aren't any books on reflection. Can't think of a single one. There are a few on contemplation. I make a distinction between reflection and contemplation, which I'm going to come on to shortly. There's one called Contemplating Reality by one of Chogyam Trungpa's disciples, but I believe it's specifically about meditation, contemplative meditation practices from the Tibetan tradition. There's another book called Insight Dialogue by Gregory Kramer, which is a very specific way of reflecting in groups of people and dialogue with, you know, where you're not reflecting on your own, you're in dialogue with others. Interesting book. But as far as I know, there's no book written, ancient or modern. I don't even know of any ancient texts that are a systematic exposition of how to reflect. And I was talking to Sangharaksha a few months ago, and he agreed with me. There's nothing. Isn't that weird? The Buddhist tradition, known for reflection, surely there's nothing written about it, as far as I know. No systematic exposition. That's not why I wrote the book. It's not that I thought, someone needs to write this book. It's only halfway through writing it. I was looking, trying to research, and I thought, there isn't anything. There is nothing. So, that's the second level. And the third level is bhavana maya panya. Bhavana, you know that word, don't you? As in metta bhavana. What does it mean? Say again. It means... Yeah. What is it again? That's metta. What's bhavana? What's bhavana? Cultivation or development. I think literally it means bringing into existence. Bringing into existence metta. And so here we are. Bhavana maya panya. Wisdom through bringing into existence, through development, through cultivation. What's that mean? Often it's understood to be wisdom gained through meditating. So here we come to that vipassana. Pasana means to see, and vi is a positive prefix, so something like to really see, to see into. And some of you will know already that there are meditation practices where you, first of all, you get into a really absorbed state of mind, you become concentrated, emotionally positive, and then you turn your mind to a Buddhist truth. And then you reflect on that, what I would call contemplate. So we come now to the difference between reflection and contemplation. In my language anyway, reflection means to think about something. Contemplation means to think of. There's a difference there, to think about and to think of. In reflection, you're using your discursive faculty, your rational faculty, you're thinking something through. You're following something through with thought. You're looking at something from different points of view. Third level, contemplation, is when you've done all your thinking. You've done all your discussing. You've done all your arguing against, perhaps. You've done all your questioning. You've done all your doubting. Just to go back to reflection again, I think an important aspect of reflection is to allow yourself to doubt things. Came across a book recently called A History of Doubt. Haven't read it yet, because I haven't bought it. But I know it's about people who have doubted something thought it through and come to a new understanding and contributed something really big to society by doing that. So A History of Doubt. I'm going to balance that with a book by Wilfred Cantwell Smith called A History of Faith. So I've got both of them there. A big part of our thinking about something, I think, will be, probably, depending on the kind of person you are, a certain amount of doubting of something. You know, when you're thinking about the Dharma, you have to allow yourself to entertain the possibility that it's not true, don't you? Have to do that, otherwise you're not really freely thinking about it. You think, this has to be true. It must be true. I cannot come to the conclusion that this is not true. Then you're not free to think about it, and reflection is a form of freedom. You're allowing your mind to freely think something through. Sometimes thinking what we sometimes call the unthinkable. Thinking things that perhaps you think you shouldn't be thinking. Allowing yourself to have that kind of freedom. That actually deepens your faith by doing that. Really looking at something, questioning it. When you come through that, then you'll find you have a deeper level of faith as a result. That's contemplation, though. Contemplation is to think of rather than think about. And it's where you've done all your thinking, you've done all your discussing, or you're writing about something, perhaps. And then you might be convinced. This is quite interesting. In the Pali text, there isn't a text, as far as I know, that goes into the three levels of wisdom. I think they're more explicated in the Savastivadin texts rather than the Pali text. So in the Pali text, there's really not very much about them at all. But you do get the three levels of wisdom embedded in another path in the Pali text, in a sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya called the Chunky Sutta. That's not Chunky, Chunky. It's Canki, the Chunky Sutta, where the Buddha goes into a 13-fold path leading to enlightenment. I can't remember all 13, but I remember some of them. And it begins with, first stage is you have to find a teacher that you can trust. And how do you do that? You test this person against greed, hatred and delusion. You look at them, you observe them for a while and see, are there actions based on greed? Or are there actions based on hatred or delusion? And if they're based on any one of those, don't follow them as your teacher. But if after looking at this person for a while you come to the conclusion, no, their actions are not based on greed, hatred or delusion, then you could, you know, make that person your teacher. And then what you do is you approach them with faith. Yeah? You approach them with faith. Then you sit down with them. Here is about number 5 here in this 13-fold path. You sit down with them. And I love this phrase, you give ear to the teacher. It's really great, that, isn't it? You give ear to the teacher. You listen to them. And then based on what they say, you gain faith, a deeper faith in their teachings. But what the Buddha says about that stage is that, okay, now you've got faith in the teachings, but just because you've got faith doesn't mean to say that you know. You cannot say at this point, this is the truth and everything else is false. You're not in a position to say that, not just with faith. You need more than that. So faith is really, really great, but it's not everything. So now you need to go further. And this is quite interesting. This is very much connected with Sutta Maya Panya. When you're listening with faith. So there's a kind of an intuitive response to what you're listening to. It's not just intellectual. So then, next stage, you give ear, you gain faith, and then you examine the teachings. And this is the second stage of the wisdom. You think about them, you examine them. Then after some time examine them, you gain reflective acceptance of the teachings. This is the way the Buddha puts it, reflective acceptance of the teachings, which is a great phrase, isn't it? Reflective acceptance of the teachings. So this is much more than just faith, because you've thought it all through now and it all makes sense to you. You've looked at it from every angle, you've questioned, and now you've got reflective acceptance of the teachings. But, the Buddha said, you still cannot go away and say, this is the truth and everything else is false. You're still not in a position to say that because you've only got reflective acceptance of the teachings. You still don't know. That's what the Buddha said. You don't know yet. It would be good if we remembered that, wouldn't it, in study groups. The French philosopher Gabriel Marcel, in one of his lectures, made a distinction between opinion and conviction. And he said opinion very often hardens into conviction through lack of reflection. So you have an opinion. We've all got opinions. That's fine to have an opinion on something. But as long as you've got an opinion, you don't know for sure. It's only an opinion. So we must remember that. But we forget very, very easily and quickly, especially in discussion groups. And you forget that you've only got an opinion, and it feels like you know, doesn't it? It feels like you know. And you get into an argument with someone, you know how it goes. Somebody says something, you disagree, so you say you disagree, that's fine. But it's when that little hot feeling comes up inside your tummy, you know, that little hot feeling. And then the other person's eyes go hard, you know. And yours go hard as well, and they've got a little hot feeling in their tummy. And then there's this, you know, no one's listening to anyone anymore, because you both know, you know. But of course you don't know, you don't know. So we must remember that. Reflection helps us to realise that we don't actually know. We don't know yet. Then you carry on. There's a whole number of more stages to enlightenment. And a lot of them contain striving. This is one of the things, this is another one of the fashions that's going through Western Buddhism, that striving's bad, isn't it? No striving. Don't strive when you meditate. Mustn't strive. But actually, there might be as many words in Pali for striving as there are words in the Eskimo language for snow. There's a lot of words for striving in Pali. Putting forth effort. You really make an effort in the spiritual life. And eventually, the next stage, or a few stages along, you gain insight into the teachings. You have a direct understanding of the teaching, direct insight. Now here's a very surprising thing. I found it surprising anyway. The Buddha then said, but when you've had a direct insight into something, you cannot go away and say, this is the truth and everything else is false. Isn't that surprising? You think, now you know, because you've had a direct insight, but no, you don't. Still don't know. Not until you gain full and complete enlightenment, which is a long, long way ahead for most of us, isn't it? So it's very good, I think, to bear this in mind, this Buddha's teaching about you don't know, just to remember that and maybe have a positive relationship with that idea of not knowing. We're a bunch of not knowers, aren't we? We don't know. Another way of thinking about that is we're all quite foolish, which we are, aren't we? If we're really honest with ourselves, if we reflect on ourselves and our behaviour, we have to admit that we're quite foolish. And it's good, to get a positive relationship with that idea. Don't allow it to make you feel bad about yourself or depressed, but have some humour around it, you know, especially in discussion groups. Okay, so now I've talked about contemplation, the third level, bhavana mayapanyawa's contemplation, but I don't think we need to think of this stage of wisdom as exclusively to do with meditation. I don't think we need to do that. You could say it's becoming wisdom. At the third stage, you become the wisdom that you've learned. This is interesting because I know a lot about Buddhism. I think actually I don't know as much as I used to know because I don't study these days. I used to study a lot. Lots and lots I studied, and I thought, I reflected, I've done 20, 30 years. Sorry, I don't know how many years, I didn't count, but many, many years reflecting and studying the Dharma, many years. So I know a lot about Buddhism. But I'm also very aware that my behaviour does not match my knowledge. I know much more than I behave, if you know what I mean. There's a very lovely... who knows the wonderful Marilyn Robinson, the novelist? Oh. You're in for a treat, honestly, with Marilyn Robinson. She's a wonderful novelist. She's only written three novels. Her first novel was called Housekeeping, which she wrote when she was just a young woman. Didn't write her second novel for until 20 years later, and it won the Pulitzer Prize. It's called Gilead, G-I-L-E-A-D. She is a practicing Christian, highly intelligent woman, very, very reflective. This novel, Gilead, is about an aged pastor in this town somewhere in America, a town called Gilead. And he's quite old, but he's taken a young wife. And they've got a very young child. And then the pastor, John Ames, he's told by his doctor that he's only got so long to live. He's got an illness, and he's only got so long to live. So he knows that he's going to die before his son can get to know him, really, grows up to get to know him. So what he does is he writes a letter or a series of letters to his son. And the whole letter is just made up of the whole novel is made up of these letters. And they're very, very reflective. Very good way to learn how to reflect is to read certain writers, good writers who are really quite free thinkers. I've learned a lot from certain writers, certainly Marilyn Robinson. Another one is Alexander McCall Smith. The novel was based on Ilbel Dalhousie, I don't know how you pronounce her name. She's a philosopher living in Edinburgh. There were four novels, I think, so far. They're very, very good because all the way through those books, Isabel is just, things happen and she thinks about them. It really teaches you how to really think about something. And this book, Gilead, is quite marvellous, actually. But in one place, I'm going to quote you. Okay, here's John Ames reflecting on grief. My custom has always been to ponder grief. That is, to follow it through ventricle and aorta, to find out its lurking places. That old weight on the chest, telling me there is something I must dwell on, because I know more than I know, and I must learn it from myself. Isn't that amazing? That last sentence there. There is something I must dwell on, because I know more than I know, and I must learn it from myself. This is a kind of slogan, in a way, for reflection. There is something I must dwell on, because I know more than I know, and I must learn it from myself. It's a very interesting idea, isn't it, that I know more than I know. We know more than we know, but we must learn it from ourselves. In the first few years or decades or lifetimes of the spiritual life, you're learning from others, those who know. But as you go on, you have to get into the second stage. At some point, you need to go into the second stage where you begin to learn from yourself. Things that you don't know that you know yet, but you kind of do already, but you haven't brought them into full awareness, full consciousness. I must learn it from myself, not from others. I was saying, wasn't I, that the third level of wisdom is when you become that wisdom that you already kind of know. You know on a certain level. I don't say that you know intellectually, because I don't think you ever know anything purely intellectually. I don't think it quite works like that. I don't think you know something intellectually, then you have to bring your emotions into play. There's a certain amount of that happening, but it's more like you know it on a certain level of your being, and then the other level hasn't been touched. And then you have to widen that level, or you have to deepen it, let's say. And the whole point of reflection is to deepen. You deepen your understanding so that it's becoming more and more you. So eventually you live the things that you know. At the moment, I'm sure we do live some of the things that we know, but we don't live everything that we know. This is what reflection really helps us to do. So, blimey, 8 o'clock already. Phew. Okay, I'm going to read you something from my book, because I want you to buy it if you haven't bought it already. Actually, I don't really need you to buy it. I don't mind if you buy it or not. You can borrow it from somebody. But Friananda wants me to try and sell it. Friananda's the manager of Windhorse Publications. Where are we now? Oh, no, it's in the first chapter. Somewhere in this book. Must be in the other one. This is giving you a little bit of time to think about what I've been saying. Okay, we have it. Getting started on reflection from the first chapter. And then we're going to do something. I want to conclude this chapter by suggesting ways you might get started on learning how to reflect. First of all, you have to learn how to do nothing. This is absolutely essential. By doing nothing, I don't mean watching the TV, listening to the radio, or reading the newspaper. I don't even mean reading a good book, not even a Buddhist one. I mean literally doing nothing. And turn off your mobile phone and computer. Make time to do nothing every day. Perhaps start with 10 minutes a day. Then, once you get used to that, extend it to 20, 30 minutes, even an hour. Make time, or it probably won't happen. Put it in your diary. Sometimes when I'm trying to arrange a meeting with someone, or if I'm asked to do something at a certain time, I'll look at my diary and see that I'm doing nothing at that time. So I'll say, sorry, I'm unavailable then. They might then ask me what I'm doing, and I'll say nothing. Incomprehension. So you can meet me then. No. But you said you weren't doing anything then. No. I said I was doing nothing. It's a different thing. My friends have got used to this, but I have to explain to people who don't know me very well that doing nothing is an important activity that I'm not willing to give up easily. We can't reflect in a hurry. We need to feel that we have all the time in the world, because deeper understanding happens in its own time. If we want to learn how to reflect, we first need to learn how to do nothing. Because it's out of the spaciousness of doing nothing that our minds can open out. This spaciousness allows our mind to range freely and unhurriedly around and through whatever it is that we've chosen to consider. We need to have a sense of timelessness. I don't mean that we enter into the infinite, although we may do, but that we feel that we have all the time in the world, that there is nothing for us to do, that it's okay to do nothing, to achieve nothing. You might think that you don't have time for this, and if that's the case, it might be a good thing to take a look at your life to see if there's anything you can cut out. Because having time to do nothing is important. However, entering into the timeless realm doesn't necessarily require a lot of time. Timeless doesn't mean lots of time. We need to feel that we have all the time in the world. Even though we may not, because of course we never do. We enter the timeless realm when we give up looking for results. When we stop trying to meet targets and deadlines. When we cease to think of time as a commodity. If we've only got 10 minutes to spare, we can enter into the timeless realm as long as we don't try to fill that time with something useful. Reflection is not useful. To reflect, we need to feel free. We need to feel that it's okay to be totally useless. Then I quote from Walter Murdoch. Anybody heard of Walter Murdoch? Nor would I until I was writing this book and I was doing some research. But this is part of a essay he wrote for a newspaper for the New Year. Let's make up our minds that in the coming year we will sit about more than we have done in the past. That is not, as you might hastily conclude, a plea for laziness. Thinking is the hardest work in the world. Most of us are too lazy to attempt it. We prefer what we call the strenuous life, which means being busy and fussy and joining a dozen committees and imagining that we are doing a great deal of good in the world and blinding ourselves to the fact that we are all suffering from St. Vitus's dance, a disease which we can cure only by shaking off our laziness and acquiring the difficult art of sitting still. So guess what we're going to do now? We're just going to sit here for 5 minutes. It's a very short space of time, doing absolutely nothing. Not meditating. Okay? We're not going to sit and meditate, because that's what some Buddhists do as soon as they get the time. Oh, could do a bit of meditation now. Do something useful. Get on with my spiritual life. No, we're not going to get on with our spiritual life, so we're going to just do nothing for 5 minutes.